This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV program on Free Speech TV and on our website. Donald Trump has escalated the U.S.'s role in the Syrian war since he came to power. He's increased the number of American troops on the ground to fight the forces of the Islamic State, or ISIS, and expanded the U.S.'s mission. Meanwhile, the Syrian government's war on rebel forces continues unabated, and peace talks come and go with little progress. Images of desperate refugees are the bulk of what we see in the media. In the midst of all this war and chaos is a small community of Syrian Kurds attempting to carve out a territory that they have fiercely protected from ISIS. The Democratic Union Party, or PYD, of the Syrian Kurds has established a growing piece of land on the Syria-Turkey border that they call Rojava. The small-scale government running this territory is a one-party state that espouses progressive values of secularism, women's rights, labor rights, and more, where women occupy 40% of decision-making positions. Indeed, it was the women fighters of the PYD that first drew some Western attention to the group, rifle-toting women successfully fighting off the masochistic and misogynist death cult of the Islamic State has made for some iconic imagery. Well, exploring the story behind the images is my guest, Meredith Tax. Meredith Tax is a writer, political activist, and author of a number of books, including Double Bind, The Muslim Right, The Anglo-American Left, and Universal Human Rights. She was a founding president of Women's World, a global free speech network of feminist writers. She also co-founded Penn American Center's Women's Committee and the International Penn Women's Writers Committee, and she's currently the international board chair of the Center for Secular Space. She now joins me to discuss her newest book. It's called A Road Unforeseen: Women Fight the Islamic State. Welcome to the program, Meredith.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it's amazing that someone's actually written a whole book about this small state, this piece of territory and the people running it, given that it hasn't gotten enough attention. How did you first come across this story of this remarkable territory and the people that run it and the values that they espouse? Where did you come across it?
I came across it during the Battle of Kobani, and also particularly in August 1914, you may remember there was some press about a bunch of people, the Yazidis, who were stranded on top of Sinjar Mountain. And I started following that because I was worried about what would happen to them. And the U.S. was sort of dithering and saying, should we drop food or would that be involving us in the Syrian war? And these people had fled from ISIS, who had invaded their city and their villages around it, and subsequently it was found had done so mainly to kill all the men and enslave the women and sell them as sex slaves in Raqqa, their capital. And once they heard they were coming, people just ran to the mountains, sometimes even without shoes or food or anything, and then they were stranded there. And nobody seemed to be doing anything about it for a couple of days. And then all of a sudden, they were gone. They had been, the U.S. had dropped food, but not anything else. But the YPG, YPJ, and other militias from Rojava, aided by ones from Turkey, had sort of made an end run around the mountain, gone up the other side, and fighting ISIS as they went had brought them into Rojava to safety. This was 100,000 people and all civilians. And I just thought that was amazing. And I wanted to know more about them. And when I started seeing these, as you say, iconic pictures of women fighters, I thought, what is going on over there? So I began to do as much research on it as I could, mostly online. And, of course, I don't speak any of those languages, so I had to deal with things in English. But even so, there was quite a bit, because there were already a lot of people in Europe who were interested and were writing things on different websites about it and on different chat rooms and
now,
so
on. I understand that the PYD is affiliated with the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party. Is that correct?
it's not a formal affiliation. What they have a common history. The PKK was founded in the 70s to fight for Kurdish liberation, which at that point they thought of in terms of an independent state, although they no longer do so. And by the way, neither do the Kurds in Rojava. They would never say that they have a mini state. They don't. They say they're against the state. They're what we would call anarchists or democratic confederalists is what they call themselves, using a term from Murray Bookchin. And they call it the self-administration. They don't believe that states are a good thing. They think states are inherently hierarchical and nationalist. So that's not what they want. They want an independent, autonomous territory.
So they control some small territories, as I mentioned, on the Syria-Turkey border. And what are those spaces like then? Let's talk about how they're organized. What is the role that women play, how they basically administer their government? Because we've heard a lot about how the Islamic State has built their own infrastructure and running a very authoritarian and you know, absolutely despicable state with a genocidal tendency. So in a way, this is sort of the other side of that coin completely. How does the PYD run their territory?
They don't actually. The PYD, although it's accused of being a one-party state, first of all, it's not a state, as I just said, and secondly, it's not. It's run by Tevdem, which is an elected sort of committee, administrative group, which is elected by communes and consuls. So every neighborhood. Or even like if you were in New York, it might be just a building. The consul is units of about a couple hundred people, and they elect representatives to the next level, which is the commune, and then the consuls all over the region will elect representatives to the Tevdem regional thing. So it's very democratic. I mean. And they also have quota systems for minorities. And each commune has a parallel structure of a separate women's commune, a separate women's council. And even Tevdem has one, which is a separate women's version of Tevdem. And they have certain rules governing the participation of women. One is that every organization, whether it's a business or a political committee or a co-op or whatever, they have a lot of co-ops, has to have two co-chairs. And this goes all the way up to the top level. And one is a male and one is a female. The other is that every group has to have 40% representation of women or of men. Sometimes they're majority women. And the third thing is they have this parallel structure of women because they think, and this is certainly my experience in the women's movement in the 70s, that in order to gain confidence and find their own voice, women need their own organizations where they can learn how to do things without men telling them all the time that they don't know how to do them. So they also have gender education in every aspect of organization, including in military training. A lot of women are joining the militias, but they aren't the only ones who have to learn about gender and about women's liberation. That's part of the curriculum for everybody in every level of education, including military education and training. And in fact, the women often become leaders, not only in their own militia, which is the YPJ, but in the mixed sex militia, which is the YPG. The person who is leading, the top general in the offensive on Raqqa among the in the Syrian Democratic Forces that are being supported by the U.S., the top general is a woman, which I've certainly never seen in any other conflict supported by the U.S. or indeed by anybody else.
So these the women fighters of this territory, I mean, so we'll stay away from the word state since they consider themselves somewhat anarchist, but the women fighters that are defending this territory from the Islamic State, how do they view themselves? I mean, the group that they're fighting is based on or bases their ideology on the subjugation of women. How important is the symbolism of their fight?
It's absolutely central. They consider ISIS their existential enemy because they want to subjugate and enslave women. And it's almost like a holy war for them that they get rid of these guys. And that they make this impossible. And the degree to which ISIS has tortured and enslaved women is hard to match in modern history. And certainly they are an existential enemy of women all over the world. And the women in the YPG say, we are fighting for you, and ask for support. And the problem is that they're surrounded by enemies. It's not just ISIS. They're under blockade by Turkey. They're under blockade by the KDP, which is the party that borders them in Syria and Iraq, and which is very close to Turkey and being influenced by it. So there's a blockade, so they can't get supplies, they can't get food, they can't build up their economy. They're trying to, they have to raise all their own food, essentially. In the beginning of the war, I mean, now they're getting some weapons from the U.S., though not as much as they want, but they were making their own tanks out of trucks and tractors. And the only weapons they had were black market Kalashnikovs because nobody would sell to them.
Are there Iraqis and or Syrians that are fleeing ISIS that are basically internally displaced, that the people living in Rojava accept as refugees? Are people basically looking at this territory as a protectorate?
Absolutely. And not only Kurds by any means. There are hundreds and thousands of Arabs and other people there. They're, Christians and Chaldeans and Assyrians and so on.
So it's multi-ethnic community right now.
Yeah, so the Kurds only make up about half of the population at this point, which is somewhere between 4 and 5 million because of all the refugees that have come in.
Wow.
So the Kurds are almost, and that's why they insist that all the communes and consuls and so on be integrated ethnically as much as possible, although a village that's all Arab can have an all Arab
commune. The Kurdish aren't just in the, it's not just the Kurdish in the leadership, it's basically Arabs and Kurds as well. Tell us about the kind of origins of some of this ideology. You mentioned Murray Bookchin, an American anarchist writer and thinker, as an influencer. Well, what about Abdullah, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Öcalan, who is influenced and was considered a founder of the PKK?
He is a founder of the PKK, and he's in jail in Turkey. He was captured in 1999 with help from the CIA. And he was a leader of the PKK from its founding. And as I said, when it started in the 70s, it was like your classic, guerrilla revolutionary group of the time, a national liberation group that thought they would, make a war in the countryside and everybody would eventually rise up and capture the country and then they would be an independent Kurdish state. Turkey has been absolutely horrible to its Kurds and continues to be so. The UN just put out a report about war crimes in the Kurdish areas in the southeast of Turkey last year, which is hair-raising. But so that the Kurds have always, or certainly since the 70s and sometimes earlier, felt the need to defend themselves. And that's where the guerrilla movement started. But it didn't really get anywhere until the 90s, when it became much more than a guerrilla movement, because people. The people had been gradually radicalized because of their mistreatment, and because so many of them were put in jail for no reason. They weren't allowed to speak their own language. They couldn't have any education in their own schools. I mean, they had economic discrimination and deprivation of all kinds, and no civil rights as Kurds. So there began to be popular movements that were also national liberation movements, and there also began to develop a parliamentary party, the most recent incarnation of which is the HDP, most of whose deputies are now in jail because of Turkey's emergency law. So anyway, so as the struggle broadened and became much more of a mass struggle, and the guerrillas were still in the countryside and the real action was going on in the cities, Öcalan began to rethink the strategy. And the party gradually changed to emphasize negotiations more and more, to say all they wanted was their own democratic rights as Kurds within Turkey, and to be able to run their own part of the country autonomously. Of course, I mean, Turkey wouldn't even let them speak Kurdish in public. So,
and in fact, I wanted to ask you, is Rojava considered the possible seed for a Kurdistan, or have Kurds basically given up on the idea of their own state?
It's difficult to see into the future. The Kurds in Iraq, Barzani's party in particular, the KDP, want their own state. But what it's going to be is like a corrupt petro-state ruled by a dictatorial tribal patriarchy. The Kurds in Syria say they do not want their own state. They want to be part of a democratic federation with local autonomy. And that's what the Kurds in Turkey say as well.
I see.
But so you have two opposing ideologies fighting for the allegiance of the Kurds, the one from Barzani's party in Iraq, which is basically very classic patriarchy combined with, you know, neoliberal ideas about money and oil, and it's very, very corrupt. And then you've got this very radical alternative, which is not ethnically based, which is secularist, which believes that the economy should be cooperative, which is anything but patriarchal, and which is ethnically pluralist.
Now, David Graeber, writing a few years ago in the Guardian newspaper about Rojava, said the autonomous region of Rojava as it exists today is one of few bright spots, albeit a very bright one, to emerge from the tragedy of the Syrian revolution. Meredith, why hasn't this gotten more support from the American left? Does it have anything to do with the fact that some of the weapons that the militia uses to protect themselves from ISIS comes from the U.S., and some people on the American left see any connection with the U.S. as basically, dooming organizations on the ground?
Yes, I think that's part of the problem. I think the main problem goes deeper than that, which is that a lot of the left here doesn't understand how to think about world politics in this period, and is still using a very outmoded Cold War framework where there are good guys and bad guys, and the U.S. is the main and only bad guy in the world, and we don't really have to pay attention to anybody except the U.S. And if we just focus on all the bad things the U.S. does and try to stop them, then the world will be fine. I mean, in fact, the U.S. is not the only bad actor in the world by any means. There's lots of other bad actors, too. And unless you can figure out something, unless you can think globally, you're not going to understand what's going on. And I mean, the same thing is, this has happened with Syria as well. The Syrian left is constantly complaining because the American left is siding with the Syrian government and Russia. I mean, not all the American left, obviously. It's very split on this. But it's this Cold War, I call it imperial narcissism, actually. Americans can't seem to know about or care about anything except what the U.S. is doing. And people on the left seem to have the same view of U.S. power as people in the Trump administration or the Pentagon, that the U.S. can do whatever it wants and it's all powerful, and you either like that or you hate it. But in fact, it's not true. The U.S. can't do whatever it wants, and it's not all powerful. There are a lot of other people.
Do you, in order to sort of put a perspective on the Syrian Kurdish fighters and the councils and the sort of democratic state that they've, state, quote unquote, that they've built up in Rojava, do you see analogies with, say, the Zapatistas in Mexico? I mean, should we be looking at this grouping, this organizational sort of experiment in democracy in that vein?
Absolutely. I mean, they consider themselves allied to the Zapatistas. They have a lot in common. I mean, Kurds are much like indigenous people anyway, in terms of the way they have been treated in most of the countries they live. And the model of sort of grassroots confederalism and democracy and the elevation of women to a position where they're able to exercise power is similar. And the Zapatistas, I think it's much more theorized in Syria because they have this guy, Öcalan, who's written all the stuff about it, which hasn't been true to the same degree in the Zapatistas. But people here have seized on the Zapatistas much more than, I mean, people are starting to know about the Kurds here, people on the left, mostly young people and mostly anarchists. But it's really important that other people find out more about them, which is why I wrote this book. To at least begin to explain what the context was. And I believe this is a world historical struggle that's going on there. There are these three models. There's, you know, the neoliberal Iraqi Kurdish model of what may be an obsolete statism. There's the horrible theocracy of ISIS. And then there's this new thing, which is a kind of grassroots participatory democracy. And I'm not saying it's perfectly achieved everything it wants to do, or that women are completely equal or anything like that. It's 4 years old, and it's at war on three fronts and just trying to survive. But it's absolutely amazing to me how much they've accomplished and how much farther they have gotten towards really bringing women's issues to the center than any other revolution I know anything about.
And there's a BBC documentary about this movement online that people can find. They don't let too many journalists in for obvious security reasons. Meredith, I want to thank you so much for your work and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Sonali. Very happy to talk about it.
My guest is Meredith Tax. She's a writer, political activist, and author. And we've been talking about her new book, A Road Unforeseen, Women Fight the Islamic State. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. And you can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.